Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to another Rahalastapad, this time with the amazing Professor Alice Roberts. It's a very brainy one. You're going to love it. We're on tour constantly with Rahalastapad in Canterbury on the 17th of July with Vic Reeves and Barry from EastEnders. Come on, there are still tickets. You've got to come. And then on in York on the 26th of July, I want to say, with the fantastic Rebecca Callard. Then I'm at the Edinburgh Fringe from the 2nd to the 25th. Of August, not Mondays, at the Newtown Theatre at 1:30 p.m. It's a great big theatre. There's lots of seats left, believe me. We've got some terrific acts booked in already, including Jen Brister, Tony Slattery, Lucy Beaumont, Phil Wang, Vicky Stone, Jeff Norcott, Richard Osman, Tommy Tiernan wants to do it, Basil Brush wants to do it. I think we can't get Eddie Izzard because he's on at the same time, sadly, but we'll see if we can sort something out along those lines. And loads more to come. So go to richtang.com/rahalastapata/tour and you can see all the links and all the guests as they get confirmed. richtang.com/gigs if you can't remember that. Do go to rahalastapa.co.uk, become a member if you want, and you can get all sorts of extras that and help pay for the podcast by becoming a monthly badger. But you can just check out the podcasts for free, and there's lots of stuff on that website as well. Anyway, come on, enough of this gabbing. Let's get on with the old podcast, the chatting, asking people if they've ever tried to suck their own cock and so on. That's mainly what happens in this one. So I hope you're going to enjoy that.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who's just been home and met the girl he fancied when he was 10 years old. It's Richard Herring. Yay! Hello! Welcome. Welcome, my friends, to this podcast. This is Richard Herring's Loganberry, Strawberry and Thimbleberry podcast. It's all about those specific three berries. The thimbleberry you may not be familiar with. It's like a wild raspberry. It's a bit soft. It doesn't preserve well as a raspberry. You can still make jam out of it. Just those three. People say, Loganberry, which isn't that a mix between a raspberry and a blackberry? It's very raspberry heavy, this new podcast idea of yours. They're not. It's different. It's a very. There's no raspberries in it at all. Only those three. Strawberry is not an official berry. I was drinking absinthe with Guy de Maupassant and Ernest Hemingway the other day. Not when I started drinking the absinthe, but once I started, they just appeared. Started drinking with me, and they both call it Rahalastapa, so I don't know if that's going to catch on. So, yeah, I returned, to my own hometown, like a sort of Jesus, this weekend, and did a gig for the Cheddar Youth Trust. I'm sure you all follow that charity. It's been going for 20 years, this charity. My dad, right at the beginning, said, just put 20 quid a month standing order on your bank account going into the charity. I said, yeah, I'll do that. It's a nice thing to do. I've forgotten to take it off. I've been paying 20 quid a month. That's about £7,000 I've paid those Cheddar Youth fuckers. And then they come and get me out to do a free gig in Cheddar when I was ill. But I just before I did this gig, this woman came up to me and said, long time no see. I kind of looked, it's cruel to do this, right? Because I hadn't seen this woman for 35 years. I was looking at her going, yeah. And then I looked at her for about 10 seconds and I realised it was Bridget, who, when I went on a school trip when I was about 11, 12 years old to France, I was completely in love with. She was a very tall, willowy beauty. I was a short, fat, little virginal schoolboy. I mean, I was 12, that's fair enough. But I was going to be a virgin for another 7 years after that as well, which is not so exciting. And I wrote funny poems for her, and every time she was around, I would sing, like a Bridget over troubled waters. That's not a good way to seduce people called Bridget. That's just a little bit of... It didn't work, but she was... It was nice. She, later on, I thought, well, maybe beforehand, you remember the Bross twins went to my school as well. She got off with both of the Bross twins separately, I believe. Even the Skellington face one. So it's lovely to see her again, but it did take me that moment to realise. It's sort of weird going back to your hometown. When I arrived, there were two, like... probably 10-year-old girls walking past my mum and dad's house in Fairlands school uniform. And I was turning in and went, yo, yo, Fairlands! And like that. And my wife said, that's probably scared those girls. They probably don't know us. They recognised me as one of them. They didn't realise that. Everything's changed in Cheddar. Every single... It used to be all fields when I was a kid. And now they've built on everywhere. And I went down the wreck, which is the one bit of the field left. And there were some kids there sitting on the wreck drinking cider like I used to when I was... 13, and my dog ran over to them, and I was thinking, everything's so different here, you know, why can't I hang out on the wreck and drink with teenagers anymore? And the dog ran over, and then they ran away, and one of the girls said, that dog is lush! And I thought, yeah, some things haven't changed. That's amazing, that's exactly what we used to say. That dog's lush! It's a very Cheddar thing, so that was nice. Ah, happy days. Anyway, I'm going to crack on with the show. My guest this week is probably best known for her thesis on rotator cuff disease in humans and apes, her paleopathological and evolution perspective on shoulder pathology. That's why we've all come tonight to find out a bit more about that. Will you please welcome the amazing Professor Alice Roberts, ladies and gentlemen? Come in, sit down. Hey, make yourself at home. A fellow, do they say lush in your part of Somerset?
Girt lush?
Yeah, girt lush. Girt lush is a bit more
lush,
Bristol.
But girt lush.
Yeah, that's a bit more Bristol. We just
that
went
is a bit
for
more
lush.
Bristol.
Went for lush. We didn't show off about our lushness. Regular. So should we talk about the pathology of shoulder? I've got a bad shoulder at the moment, so I thought that's partly why I brought this up. So I wondered if you could help me out with...
This is the thing, everyone's got bad shoulders.
Yeah.
It's one of the most common pathologies as you get older.
You can write a thesis about
and
it.
I did my PhD quite late because I did it when I'd already qualified as a doctor and I was already lecturing and anatomy, and I did it really slowly over 7 years. And as I did my PhD, I developed rotator cuff disease. And so I was looking at ancient skeletons that had these things that I could kind of feel in my own shoulders. And I've definitely got osteoarthritis from my clavicles, but everyone's got that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was fascinating.
Because what I've got, I just got you on to try and diagnose this. I went to my doctor and he just said, take ibuprofen.
Pretty much.
He said, have you been doing that? Yeah. And I said, no. And he said, well, do that. It annoys me when people come around and they haven't even done that. I said, I've never hurt my arm before. So it hurts like there, and it hurts if I go like that.
Yeah.
And it used to hurt when I did that, but it's not so bad now. It's when I read. Is that it?
And what a bit of subacromial impingement there, I think.
It's just down there.
There's too many things. There's this bit of bone. There's this bit of bone that sticks out here called the acromion, which is badly named because it means the top of the shoulder, but it's not actually the top of the shoulder because the lateral clavicle is higher than the acromion. I know.
I knew these guys would love that stuff. I think you've found your crowd.
Yeah.
Try that at the comedy store later on a Saturday. You're getting nothing but here.
But it's all these things underneath. It's like the bit of biceps goes up, the long head of biceps, and then supraspinatus tendon. There's a subacromial burst. So there's just too many things in one
What do
space.
I do to make my arm better is why. That's the only reason you had.
Rest it a bit and take some ibuprofen.
Ages. I've had it for two series of rehearsals, but that's how. Well done. Congratulations. The other thing I was going to say is your best-known thing, which I think is too impressive to be your best-known thing, is that you won the Blue Peter Young Artist of the Year in 1988 and were on the cover of the Radio Times with Mark Curry. Was he one of them?
Yeah. And Yvette Fielding.
Yeah, Yvette Fielding. Two of the, you know, they're the sort of Sylvester McCoys of the Blue Peter world.
But I was annoyed, though, about that.
Why?
The whole thing was, like, faintly annoying. Because the competition was to design the cover of the Radio Times. So I did a really nice picture that was the cover of the Radio Times. It even had a gap at the top where you could write Radio Times. And then they obviously decided that actually what they wanted to do was have the presenters on the cover. So they weren't going to have the picture. And then they, as a kind of sop to me, they said, well, we'll have your picture as though it's in an art gallery and you can be in it too. And I was like, I don't really want to be in it. I just want my picture to be on the front of the Radio Times. Lies. Wow. Is the BBC lying again? Well, Blue Peter's got a history of it, of course, hasn't it? With the cats as well, the cat
and,
names.
Yeah, taking coke all the time as well. They do.
No, yeah, that too.
That's why they don't care. They're, do we even do? I don't remember doing a competition. Fuck, we're going to have to... It's off my fucking tits that day. There's no way we can get a kid to design the cover of the Radio Times. Who's like, who said that was going to happen? Must be very happy. Did you get invited to the end of your Radio Times party where all the cover stars get to go?
Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah, I did.
Did you go?
Yeah.
Wow.
I didn't know who anyone was. But they had good nibbles. Yeah.
Good nibbles?
Yeah.
Yeah, good nibbles. Okay. Yeah. Those topless end of year Radio Times parties, notorious. So you were very talented even from a very young, so you were 14 or 15 back then.
Yeah, I was 14 when I did the picture.
It's incredible. And that's not, you're not even gone on to be an artist. You've gone on to be all these other things. You are author, TV presenter.
Oh, I kind of struggled with it because I wanted to do art. I really wanted to do art. And I did, and I kind of dabbled with it a bit. So I did have once a best-selling range of dinosaur cards in WH Smith.
Did you?
That's how I funded my anatomy degree. I mean, they were awful. I'm kind of really embarrassed with them now. They're kind of like little pink stegosauruses and purple iguanodons.
That is probably not accurate.
Yeah, but nobody knows.
We don't know,
do
we? We don't know what colour they were.
They weren't feathery, though. They should have been feathery, shouldn't they?
They should have been, really. Yeah. If anyone wants a refund on those dinosaur postcards, do get in touch. One of the first times I became more aware of you, because you've been going since... You were on Time Team, weren't you, early on? So I must have seen you on that, because I love Time Team. But... The Incredible Human Journey, which is a series you did, and there was a book accompanying that, which came out at the same time as I was doing a show called Hitler Moustache, which I grew a Hitler moustache for some reason. Can't, I think to be offensive to people. In order to look at our attitudes towards people with Hitler moustache. It turns out, not good. People are still quite anti-Hitler. But the show was sort of about race and the way that idea that the British National Party claiming, you know, we're British, we're from Britain, the only people from Britain are allowed to be in Britain. And that book was about the idea that we've all come from. Well, at that point, things have changed in the last 9 or 10 years, but we've all come
science
from
does that. A little, annoying.
For we've all come from West Africa, and every human being who isn't African is related to this. Basically one tribe who left Africa about 70,000 years ago.
So that was my first big landmark series on the BBC. So we went off filming that in 2008 and just went everywhere. And it was an extraordinary experience, and, you know, met some interesting people, getting filmed with Bushmen in Namibia and reindeer herders in Siberia. But when you're actually out doing that kind of filming, mostly what you feel like you're doing is moving 36 really large pieces of luggage around the world and then occasionally fitting in a bit of filming in the gaps.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was. I loved it, and I think that there's that really positive side of science that I've always been interested in conveying, and that it's humanitarian and humane, and it's about empathising with everybody because everybody's a cousin.
Yes. Well, it's sort of it's crazy, that idea anyway, of anyone being, as all these now, these DNA tests people can do, which you've done one. You're 2.9% Neanderthal.
2.7%.
Sorry.
But still more than Bill Bailey.
Yeah.
Which is... It was surprising.
Yeah. I mean, 2.7 is a lot, though. That's like a foot, isn't it? That's, we can see your feet, so it must be something, maybe a shin.
Yeah, maybe. I got interviewed for the Natural History Museum Human Evolution Gallery about that. In fact, I think they arranged the test. And they said, oh, you know, it's a bit of fun, really, because obviously you can't trace your family history back as far as when your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandma or granddad was a Neanderthal. But have a chat to your parents about your more recent family tree. So I did. And then in the context... So I'd spoken to them both separately, and my dad said, you're 2.7% Neanderthal. That'll be your mum's side, because she's the short and stocky one. and so I said this when I was interviewed by Chris Stringer at the Natural History Museum, and it's still in the video. And this is meant to be like a temporary exhibition, but now it's turned into a permanent exhibition.
Right.
I thought I was completely safe, because my mum comes up to London, she never goes to the Natural History Museum, she goes to the V&A. Yeah. And then, you know, sort of about a year later, she said, one of my friends has been to London, Alice, I've got a bone to pick with you.
Well, really with your dad, to be fair, it's who said it.
Yeah, exactly, blame him, yeah.
They were a bit bigger than us Neanderthals anyway?
They were slightly more muscly.
Yeah.
They had bigger brains than us on average as well. Yeah. It's interesting.
So there was a lot of... I mean, they didn't used to think this was the case, but there was a lot of interspecial having a little crack in going on, especially in your family, but 2.9%. 2.7% was...
I know.
That's a lot of shagging Neanderthals.
It's just... So when I made that Human Journey series, they got out some mitochondrial DNA, which is just a little tiny bit... but quite good for tracing family histories back. And there wasn't any suggestion that there'd been any interchange of genes between modern humans and Neanderthals. Then they did the genome. They managed to get a whole genome sequenced and went, it turns out we did. And then it's not just... The revelations have just come thick and fast since then. So that the paper that dropped that bombshell was 2010, I think.
Right.
The year after my programme, my series went out,
we definitely didn't interview the Neanderthals.
And then, of course, the BBC repeat everything.
Yeah.
So that series has just been on again, with people going, hang on a minute. I thought... Anyway, since 2010, we've then had all these other revelations of interbreeding with... basically, any other human species we find and we can get the DNA out of, we've interbred with them.
Yeah. I mean, you would, though, wouldn't you? There's not much... Especially in the olden days, there wasn't much... I'd have shagged a couple of monkeys if I'd been. I would definitely have, you know, just to see what came out. Especially in those early days when evolution was really happening, right? Never know what's going to come up. But definitely, if a Neanderthal came in here now, I'd ring my wife and say, there's a Neanderthal, quite attractive Neanderthal. I don't care, male or female. Out of scientific curiosity, surely you must be the same. I'm going to have to shag it, but I still love you. And and I didn't promise not to shag a Neanderthal, if you remember back to the battle. You would, though, wouldn't you? You'd have just be interested to see.
I wouldn't.
To see what it's like. there's another whole species of Denisovia? What did you say it?
Anyway you want, really, but yeah, Denisovans. And they're from this cave called Denisova, which I think just means Dennis's cave in Siberia.
So it was just one bloke called Dennis who was this species.
And so they had two teeth and a finger bone.
Yeah.
And nobody knew what it was from. And then they got DNA out of it, and it was different from us, and it was different from Neanderthals. And so they've called it Denisovans. They can't give it a species name, because you can't give a species name just on the basis of DNA. But we don't know what it looks like. It's very frustrating for me. I mean, I'm a bone specialist. I want to actually look at some bones, and it's not really much. Oh, they found a bit of skull recently.
Right.
I got excited about that. And they were like, oh, I found a bit of skull that belongs to the Denisovans as well. And I was like, oh, good. I hope it's an exciting bone, like the sphenoid bone or the temporal bone. And it was the parietal. I mean, who wants a bit of parietal?
Always, isn't it? Oh, it's always this rubbish. But we're related to, there's some of them in us as well, is that right?
Yeah. Especially
you can just get that from a finger, that's amazing.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, you've got there's a lot of DNA in all of you.
Yeah, there is. It's clever, isn't it? Just need a little bit. I've seen Jurassic Park, I know how it works. So
I watched it with my kids yesterday.
Yeah.
I said to them, I've got a 5-year-old, which is probably, you know, possibly not a good idea to watch Jurassic Park with a 5-year-old because it's quite scary. And I said, look, there's scary bits in this, and just if you want it to stop, just say, and you can come and sit next to me. And we stopped it before the scene with the velociraptors in the kitchen. And then we said, now this is a scary bit, so do you want to stop it? And they were like, no, it's just getting good. But there was one bit that my little boy kind of came cuddling up to me, and I thought he was scared of something. And he said, Mummy. And Sam and I had just been having this conversation about not wanting children because they're too expensive. And he kind of cuddled up to me and went, Mummy, he said children were expensive. And I said, yeah, you are. And he said, but you didn't buy me.
It's good. So it's very educational. It's a very educational film. So what's the truth? What is the truth of humanity? Where did we come from? There's been lots of people coming out of Africa at different times, obviously.
Yeah.
So there was the Neanderthals and Homo erectus.
Yeah, Homo erectus.
Yeah.
Homo. This is, honestly.
What?
I do. So I go and talk to crowds of 15-year-old school kids, and I talk to them about Homo erectus, and I always kind of wait, and there's a little titter, and I go, oh, you're more mature than the last group. You're not.
So there's several.
There's about 20. Do you want to go through them?
Yeah, I do. I'd like to know where we came from. Because I thought we all came from the same one.
Okay, so some of the early ones, there's things like Sahelanthropus gigantensis, which comes from Chad about 6 or 7 million years ago. Nobody really knows what it looked like, apart from it had quite a small head. There's Orontogonensis. There's Canyanthropus platyops, because it's got a kind of flat face. Again, these are quite scrappy fossil remains. Don't really know much about those. Then there's these interesting ones called Ardipithecus. Ardipithecus ramidus. Still pretty ape-like, although that's always tricky. You kind of tie yourself up in knots because we're apes. But when you say ape-like, you mean more like the other apes than us apes. And then, of course, you get famous ones like Lucy, who's famous because she was discovered when they were listening to Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, I think. And quite a complete fossil. 40% is pretty complete in human paleontology. And then a little bit later, you get our own genus. You know, their brains are a bit smaller, but they have a similar kind of body shape to us, so they don't look like anything like chimpanzees anymore. They've got really long legs. They were good runners. And then they kind of expand. We think they expand out of Africa. Well, they might not have done. It depends how long you've got. They might have arisen in Asia and then gone back into Africa. We don't really know.
Okay. No, you don't know anything, do you? You write a book and then 10 years later it's all out of date. My show looks ridiculous now, Hitler moustache show.
It's like with any of this science, though, the more you know, the more you just think you don't actually know definite answers to things. But I'm sure that Homo sapiens, our species, modern humans, evolved in Africa. Because we've got fossils of Homo sapiens going back much, much earlier in Africa than we have anywhere else around the world. And so about 200,000 years of existence in Africa before we're seen anywhere else. And then genetically, Africans are much more diverse than the rest of the world put together. And you tend to see more diversity in the place that a species has been the longest.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, we're an African species.
And you went to... there's that Hobbit species, isn't there, which was just on one island. You've seen that skeleton, have you?
I laid out the bones. I mean, that was amazing. That was for that series. And we sat down with the Indonesian scientists and had a long discussion with them. And they said, what do you do? And I said, I'm a biological anthropologist, so I do skeletons, really, is my thing. And then after about an hour's discussion with them, they said, okay, you can lay it out. And I was like, really? And so there was this cabinet with lots of little Tupperware boxes, like little sandwich boxes, and that's what The Hobbit was in.
Yeah.
And I unpacked her and laid her out. And yeah, she was amazing. That sent a shiver down my spine because she was such a weird little thing.
Yeah.
Very odd.
And so is that thought to be like an anomaly, or is that there was a population of just small people on this island?
It was really controversial when it was published. And there were a lot of people saying, as quite often happens with these kind of odd surprises in paleoanthropology, people will say, oh, it's just an error. Or it's maybe a pathological. It doesn't look pathological. And there's lots of them that are all very similar. So I don't think they're pathological. I think they're normal for Homo floresiensis. But we don't really know what they are. I mean, some people say they're Homo erectus that's got small because they lived on an island. Some people say they might be an earlier expansion out of Africa, so something more like Lucy, in fact.
Yeah.
And actually, careful analysis of those skeletons has suggested that they do seem to hark back to something very early.
Okay.
So there could have been an earlier expansion that we haven't picked up elsewhere.
They're not really hobbits, though, right? They're not loads of dead hobbits.
No.
Be good if they were. Prove Lord of the Rings, right? And so... So is that part of the journey to Australia? Because it's sort of incredible that humans made it to Australia, but was that sort of within the last 50,000 years, or was that...
The dates have been pushed right back, actually. So, again, 10, 11 years ago when we made the series, we did cover some quite controversially early dates from a couple of rock shelter sites in the Northern Territories, and that's now been vindicated. So we know now that modern humans got to Australia about 65,000 years ago.
Right.
And there's a nice convergence of archaeological sites and genetics that shows that.
Right.
See, way before they got to Europe.
And what about all... Because in Australia, they were like all crazy, I mean, marsupials, but also giant kangaroos and just huge animals. When did those animals... Did those animals get at the same time, or are they even more ancient? Did they drift across with the...
Oh, they're even more ancient. So, yeah, there are all these Australian megafauna, big animals. And there's a... sort of stunning coincidence between the arrival of humans in Australia and the disappearance of all the megafauna.
That's right.
The same as in America. I mean, I don't think our ancestors went on rampages killing everything, but I think they had a big impact.
You'd have a go if there was a giant kangaroo around. I'd definitely try and kill it.
Especially if it'd never seen a human before. It would probably just let you walk up to it.
Yeah. I'd want to try a bit and see what it tasted like.
Yeah.
I've eaten some kangaroo, it's all right. I mean, it's not worth wiping out the species for. But I never got a really big one, so I don't know. Imagine a big kangaroo rib, like Fred Flintstone, wouldn't it? It'd be good. You'd be hard to resist. Has anyone ever confused you with Victoria Coren?
Well, I get this occasionally on really Twitter. Like, people say, you look like Victoria Coren. I think,
Look like Victoria Coren.
I've never met Victoria Coren in the flesh.
Maybe so you are Victoria Coren.
There's a possibility we are the same person. But I don't think so. There's another thing, though. People go... I mean, this used to happen to me when I kind of started out doing television. I was doing Time Team, and then I did Coast on BBC Two. And I remember going... this is a very glamorous story. Going to Shepton Mallet Antiques Fair with my parents-in-law. And there were two things that happened to me that day which really kind of brought me down, to size and, feet on the ground and all that sort of thing. One was I was in the middle of eating a pasty, which is always a bad moment to interrupt someone, I think. And this guy came over and went, can you settle a bet? And I said, I don't know. Can I? And he said, are you on Coast? And I said, yes. And he went, I've lost a tenner. And then the next one was this woman walked up to me. I was just looking at a nice table, thinking about maybe getting a new table. And this woman walked up to me and went, oh, can I have your autograph? And I said, yeah, of course you can. And she went, I don't have a pen. And I was looking in my bag for a pen. And she went, and you are Miranda Krestovnikov. And I said, I'm not actually, but do you want me to forge her name or can I write my own? But there is that thing of I'm just like a woman on television, and there's this like sort of...
You should think that would make you remarkable. People go, it's the woman from telly.
Yeah, it's that one. What's her name? Yeah, Victoria Coren, Miranda Krestovnikov. You get there eventually.
So what was it like being on... We were behind the scenes on Time Team to begin with, because you're an expert on bones, right? So that's
I was just writing bone reports for them. Right. They'd just send me boxes of skeletons and I'd write the reports for them. And then they asked me to go along on a dig in 2001 because they knew they were going to excavate a cemetery, basically, so they knew we were going to have lots of bones. So that was my kind of debut on Time Team, and they kept on asking me back, and yeah, I kind of thought that was probably going to be it. And then I was sitting in my office one day, and somebody from the BBC rang me and said, "We're doing something about coastal Britain, and wondered if you'd be interested." I thought, that sounds intriguing.
How many bones are in it? Are there going to be bones?
Yeah, I did insist on bones, actually. So, yeah, I ended up doing it and said, right, we've got to have some bones. Got to do Paviland Cave.
And what was it like hanging around with the Time team? There must have been some crazy times brilliant. With those guys.
It was really brilliant. It was it was good fun. People always go, oh, why does Time Team have to happen in 3 days? And it's just because it takes a week. Because you go on Monday, you travel to the place, you spend 3 days digging, and on Friday you go home. During that week, you're staying in a... They used to book big hotels and put everybody up in the same hotel. And it was always, obviously, the kind of same core team of presenters and diggers. But all the crew were the same as well. So there was a great sense of camaraderie. A really great sense of camaraderie. And then day three was always very difficult because everyone was just dreadfully hungover. I mean, we're just there going, oh, don't come and talk to me. Just let me get on with this. Little trench and just I don't want to find anything. I don't want to.
But then half the time you had to kind of cook up like mead and stuff and be drinking it in a
Only if you didn't find anything. It's quite interesting looking at Time Teams, and you always know that they're really struggling and they're not finding stuff if people start dressing up.
Because they did. I think Cheddar Gorge was one of your worst ones. I don't know if you did. You go to the Cheddar Gorge?
No, I did. I wasn't on that one. The worst one I did was a site in Sunderland, where I started off on the wrong foot because I thought, oh, you know, we had a few local diggers, and I said, I didn't really know much about Sunderland, but I told them that my best friend at university was a Newcastle supporter, so that was that really. Yeah. And then we spent 3 days looking for a Roman fort, and we found a path, and that was it. 3 days of digging.
Wasn't even
in a path.
Underground. It was just. But that's the beauty of archaeology. I did a bit of archaeology when I was on my gap year off.
Did you go to exotic places?
No, I went to a field in Hampshire, which is quite nice, and a field in Reading, which wasn't very nice. That wasn't very good. Fun, though, isn't it, digging stuff up and trying to work out what it is?
Yeah, I mean, I like the whole process of it, and I've done it for a long time because my boyfriend at university was an archaeologist, so basically the only way I could get to spend any time with him in the summer was by going and volunteering on archaeological digs. So I did have a bit of experience doing digging, but I just like being outside and digging holes.
Yeah, it's nice. It was very sunny on the one I went on. It was nice.
It's not always sunny though.
No, it was nice. I got off with a Dutch girl. It was good. Wish I could go back. Talking of which, you did this show where you they created a kind of. Sort of Margaret Atwood version of you with the perfect body.
Yeah, it was
where
weird.
You had ostrich legs and sort of elves' ears.
We just had a bit of fun with it. It basically came out of conversations I'd had with Roger Highfield, who's the creative director of the Science Museum, over the years. And also just stuff I talk about generally, that, you know, the whole fact that evolution doesn't produce perfection. It just kind of produces things, you know, it's natural selection working on the material that's already there. And it's kind of, it's good enough. And so, you know, the human body is good enough. It's pretty good. I'm an anatomist. I became an anatomist because I was fascinated with how, you know, intricate and wonderful it is. But there's lots of bits of it where you go, I could do that better. If I was God, not that I believe in God, but if I did believe in God and I was God, I'd redesign it.
It's easier if you are God. That's the thing. That's what gets to me.
Well, so that's what I got to do on that programme. Yeah. So I basically said, right, there's some stuff you don't even see and you don't know about, but stupid things like this nerve, the recurrent laryngeal nerve, which starts in the neck, it branches off its parent nerve right up here, just under ear, and then it kind of gets lost. It goes all the way down to your chest, and then it goes, oh, I forgot, and goes back up the neck and goes into the larynx. And you go, oh, that's ridiculous. Just have it coming straight off. So there's all this kind of messy wiring, messy plumbing, which could be sorted out if you didn't have to grow as an embryo. That's the kind of tricky thing, because embryonic development kind of has to go in a certain way.
If you're God, you don't have to, you can start getting
rid
of that.
Yeah, you could just go, boom, and you don't have to have any of that evolutionary baggage. So when we were making the programme, it was called Perfect Body Always, and then as quite often happens, they change the title like a week before it goes out, and they go, "Oh, it's called Can Science Make Your Body Perfect Now?" And I was like, "That sounds like a cosmetic surgery programme. Really weird." But yeah, so the other thing about it was that when we talked about it and talked about the idea of it, I hadn't really anticipated that the producers were going to turn around and go, "And we're going to do your body." And I was like, "Oh, really? Right." So I got scanned. Which is, yeah. I mean, that's just awful.
And that sounds like the producer going, "Oh yeah, we've got to scan your body. It's not for us, it's just for the show." No. I'm not doing anything with the scan, make a 3D model of that, take that God. Home.
I could do that actually, because I've got the data. I could 3D print out tiny really? Alice Roberts. Oh dear. So yeah, we had a lot of fun with it, and we kind of said, well, human legs, they're generalist legs. They're pretty good at lots of different things, like they're good at climbing, they're good at swimming, they're good at running. Let's just focus on one thing. Let's focus on running. What do legs look like if you're just doing running? So ostriches are pretty good runners. So I ended up with these kind of weird ostrich legs. But the really odd thing about it was that I was working very closely with this artist all the way through, and he was absolutely brilliant, and we met up and talked about how the body was going to be adapted for the first couple of tweaks, like things like slightly shortening the spine to make it more stable. But then the producer said, "Would you just let him get on with it now, and you're not to see it anymore, and you can just have phone conversations with him about it?" So I kind of played along. So then we had this unveiling at the Science Museum, and I think I actually screamed when it when they took the veil. I was like, it was just so freaky.
Well, also because you had the version of you had a marsupial pouch. So yeah. There's a baby's head in your stomach. I mean, it's really like, it's sort of like an emergency question. The whole thing is an emergency. If would you rather have an ostrich's legs or a baby's head in your stomach? Good question.
It was just, that was something I was really keen on there, because I'd done a bit of just kind of scoping and asking people on Twitter what they would change. And, of course, loads of people came back, loads of women, but men as well, came back and, "Can you fix childbirth?" And I was like, "Yeah, I've had 2 children. Let's fix childbirth." So I talked to the producers about that, and I said, "Oh, I want to fix childbirth." And they said, "OK, what were you thinking? Maybe making the pelvis slightly wider and the baby's head a little bit smaller?" And I was like, "No, radical. Let's go marsupial." And they were like, "Really?" And then I think they had to have all these kind of conversations with the head honchos at the BBC about whether that was going to be OK. And I was like, I absolutely stuck to my guns. I was like, "No, this is going to happen. I want to have, you know, in this kind of fantasy, I want to have the ability to give birth to something the size of a jelly bean. And then just put it in a pocket.
Yeah.
And then when it's ready, you just take it out. It's brilliant. And then you've got somewhere to put your mobile phone." So
it would be useful to have pockets, generally.
I'd love a tail, though. I think it's a shame in human evolution that we descended from old world monkeys. And then old world monkeys became apes, these sort of heavier old world monkeys, but without tails. And I would love to have descended from new world monkeys, like spider monkeys, with prehensile tails.
Yeah.
I think that would be amazing.
Some people do have tails, though, don't they? Have a little tail.
Some people have extra bits of coccyx.
Yeah.
This is the coccyx is quite interesting, because people say, "Oh, well, then, you know, that's a vestige." It's absolutely not. I mean, it is, I suppose, where our tails have shrunk to. But it's kind of really important, because if it shrunk any more, there's nothing for your pelvic floor to attach to.
Right.
And that's kind of necessary. To stop everything falling out on the floor.
You want to be in one bit, yeah.
Yeah. I broke my coccyx once.
Yeah, I saw you talk about that. What, you were doing something silly?
I was dancing on a table with my friend Julia. Yeah. Many years ago. Many, many years ago.
You fell on your bum, broke your coccyx.
Fell on my bum, broke my coccyx, yeah.
I broke my coccyx once.
How did you do it?
No, I didn't. I was trying to make a rude joke about cocks, but it didn't come out well.
Has anybody in the audience broken their coccyx ever? It's so painful. It's so ridiculously painful. I mean, I didn't really experience the pain that night, I must say, but I woke up the next morning going, "What the hell happened there?" And, you know, could hardly sit down for weeks, and it was just awful. But as an anatomist, I get these kind of, you know, strange satisfaction and fulfilment from knowing exactly what has gone wrong. So, as I said, the coccyx is important because the pelvic floor attaches to it. And the pelvic floor is obviously what keeps all the stuff on the inside when you want it to be kept on the inside. And then when you urinate or defecate or have a baby, it has to relax to let everything out. But it also does this thing of keeping things on the inside at moments when you really don't want things to come out. So if you cough or sneeze, your pelvic floor reflexively contracts to try and keep everything on the inside. Somebody just coughed then in the audience. So your pelvic floor just went, kept everything on the inside. And just after breaking my coccyx, I had a cold. And so every time I sneeze, I'd be like, achoo, ow. But I knew what was happening, so I got some satisfaction from that.
I thought you were going to say you weed yourself every time you sneezed. But this is an inappropriate conversation. I'll have to lose this from the show. Can't have stuff like that on this podcast. It's a very...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare tri-term medical plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I've been listening to your audiobook. Thank you for reading it yourself. I like that. Not many people read their own audiobooks.
I'm far too much of a control freak that anybody else reads.
Much better.
It.
When
I
was like,
how to pronounce things.
You know how to pronounce things. You know what the author was thinking. I was saying backstage, I've been listening to Sapiens by that what's his face Harari. You're not a fan. I'm not a fan of the bloke reading the audiobook because he says everything in American. He does numbers like in 21 centuries. It doesn't say 25th or 20 whatever.
I think I just find it a bit disappointing. It's only those books with a kind of big thesis, but there's not, when you actually look at the foundations of it, it seems a bit shaky. And a lot of the paleoanthropology is about 30 years out of date. I don't like that in a book.
Stop changing it all then. Okay. Just keep it the same. Make up your mind what happened and stick to it. Stop being a scientist and finding out you were wrong. But yours is great, and it's a really interesting subject matter. So it's called Tamed. It's about the animals and plants and ourselves that have become domesticated by humans, and the effect that sort of has a reciprocal. So the first chapter is about dogs, which you don't, and the way wolves turned into dogs. And
I got a bit obsessed with the dogs as well. I was like, right, so basically each chapter is going to be 10,000 words, and then 30,000 words into dogs. I was like, I might have to stop writing about dogs.
It's really interesting though, because I think it's sort of, you have this idea. I think people have the idea about evolution that it's partly because of that image of the monkey turning into the bigger monkey turning into the man, the caveman.
That it's this.
Process this road that was always going to lead to us, which obviously it isn't. It's this kind of incredible random thing, and that kind of reciprocation of the dog and the wolves and the men and women working together, and the way that possibly even helped us evolve into the next stage ourselves, or in the societal terms anyway. A dog is a guard dog, that a wolf coming nearer to the camp helps you. They help you hunt, and then also you're creating this new species. We're accidentally, obviously, from a lot of this domestication is...
Yeah, I think a lot of it starts by accident. So we like to tell these kind of quite heroic stories about the past, where our ancestors were always, in charge and coming up with brilliant ideas. And I think a lot of the time they're just making mistakes and noticing stuff.
Yeah.
So when it comes to domesticating wheat, I think the most likely thing is that people were already harvesting wild grasses and bringing them back and threshing them. And they notice that little wheat plants start to grow up around the threshing floor. So it's kind of about noticing stuff rather than going, oh, do you know what we're going to do today? We're not going to be hunter-gatherers anymore. We're going to go and sow a field of wheat.
Yeah.
And it's less kind of heroic. But yeah, what you're saying about chance, I mean, I think we really underplay chance, serendipity, just these kind of... There's a randomness in evolution, but also in history as well. You know, the events could have gone off in a completely different direction had it not been for, you know, something falling out a certain way. But I think we do that in our own lives too. I think there's a lot, you know, we like to think that we're in charge of our own destinies, and there's a lot about our lives where you're not in charge of it at all, and it's pure chance that you've gone down one route and not another.
It's all chance. Have you seen the film Sliding Doors? Rubbish, isn't it? It's really bad. It's really stupid. But that, you know, it is. If wolves hadn't, if there hadn't been the slightly tamer wolves, if the wolves had all run away, and that, you know, that we would, if we didn't have dogs, would we have turned out at all? Like, you know, would human beings have turned out the way they have? Would we have survived? Yeah. All those questions. You sort of feel that. I think the amazing thing about the book, it's such a complicated subject because all these things, to try and understand the consequences they've had. I mean, you could do it in hindsight in a way, but it's such a broad.
Yeah,
amount of,
yeah.
You're taking 10 or 12 items, aren't you?
But it is about these kind of intertwined histories, and then trying to always kind of doing that alternative history thing where you go, right, if things had turned out differently, if you took that species away, how different would human history have been? And I think for some of them, it's really profound. So I think without horses, human history would have been really different. I mean, horses really underpin warfare for most of human history. So yeah, I think it would have been
no
very
dressage
different.
Either. There'd be no dressage.
No.
So you think how different things would have been. Princess Anne wouldn't be as famous as she is.
But the other thing was all the interbreeding, and that's what really spurred me on to write that book.
About the royal family.
I started to. I don't know about that. Yeah, I just kept on finding these stories of species interbreeding with other species. I thought, you know, that's been a bit of a revelation and a shock in human evolution. And it turns out that everything else has done it too, even apples. So
yeah, they're randy apples.
They really were.
But you know, it's a really fascinating book, and we sort of domesticated ourselves as a species as well. You know, we've tamed ourselves without knowing that we have as well, to become a sort of civilized.
Yeah,
and therefore yeah. Changed quite dramatic. It's sort of interesting when you talk about the domestication of dogs. A, that most species of dogs have only been around for a couple of hundred years, so that sort of shows how quickly these things, especially if you push them in a certain direction,
yeah.
How quickly evolution actually does happen. The idea that the thing that used to get quoted was that all dogs are related to the same pack of wolves from 30,000 years ago, which might still be true. But there might be two or three packs of wolves.
Yeah.
But the idea that when you see a Great Dane and a Pekingese dog next to each other, and you go, you're all related to the same wolf.
They're all 99.5% genetically European grey wolves.
Yeah,
it's utterly amazing to think this is Chihuahua is basically 99.5% grey wolf. It's just, it is bizarre.
But when you're picking out animals to be more docile, and it's still the truth. With human beings as well, if you try that also has effects on other aspects of their DNA. The DNA sort of linked together, or just the ears change, the snouts
yeah,
change,
so,
the brows.
Well, it can
change.
Happen at a genetic level. So if natural selection's acting on a particular gene or a particular genetic variant, then also the genes either side of it are likely to be quite protected as well. They might be doing something completely different. So that's one way it can happen. And another way it can happen is just that our bodies are really complicated. So you know, genes might be doing more than one job in a developing embryo, for instance.
And then
when you add in, you know, all the other kind of messaging that we've got going on in our bodies with hormones, then it all just starts to get really, really complicated. But yeah, interesting things come along for the ride. And, you know, with dogs, we've seen that really brilliantly. Well, not with dogs, but with a closely related species. We've seen it brilliantly demonstrated with the breeding of silver foxes in Russia, which has been this experiment which has gone on for I think about 5 decades. And initially the silver foxes were just bred to be tame. So they would just take the 10% tamest foxes in each generation and then breed them on. And tameness and friendliness spread very quickly through that population, really, really quickly. So very quickly you had a population of silver foxes that were very comfortable around people, licking the keeper's hands, not biting them. But then they were doing other things as well. They were wagging their tails. They hadn't selected for tail wagging, but that had just come along for the ride.
Yeah.
And also their coat colour started to vary. And some of them ended up black and white, like collies. It's mad. So there's all these kind of extra things. So one of the lessons from that is that you have to be really careful when you look at the anatomy or the physiology of an animal about saying that every single bit of it is an adaptation, because a lot of characteristics are probably like that. They're probably just coming along for the ride rather than being specifically selected for.
And I think it's the idea as well of that survival of the fittest is quite an unhelpful phrase, for example, which I think which people misunderstand, because it doesn't mean that the most,
it's a Victorian phrase, and it's not even something that Charles Darwin coined. It means that you fit your environment.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that you're fit in a kind of...
you could be the weakest animal, and that could be good in the environment you're in. Like, you know,
It's hard to think of a scenario where the weakest animal would be the best.
Well, in that...
the best bit, but...
You could be a tiny... Yeah. If you're a tiny animal in a world where there's no food, then you'll survive and the big animals won't. So the fit animals won't survive. So like in that sense.
Yeah, it is about fitting your environment. Yeah. And also it's going to change, you know, every generation it's going to, the game changes slightly. Yeah.
And what becomes fit to one, you know, situation is then not if when human beings turn up in Australia or wherever and kill everything, suddenly you weren't the best for your environment anymore.
No, so, you were great until the humans turned up. Yeah. It's like dinosaurs. Dinosaurs were amazing and had diversified into all these different environments. But you can't, you know, you can be really evolutionarily fit, but if a massive rock drops out of the sky, it just, curtains.
We got through there, didn't we? Little rats.
Yeah, little scurrying mammals. Yeah. Well, that's another great example of chance and kind of chance events. If that rock, that massive asteroid hadn't slammed into the Earth, into the Yucatan Peninsula, 66 million years ago, and basically finished off the dinosaurs and a lot of the rest of life on Earth, you know, 3/4 of life on Earth was wiped out by that, mammals would not have got the chance to diversify.
No.
So it's kind of, when the dust cleared, it was like, oh, the dinosaurs are gone. Brilliant. And then you get this very quick radiation of mammals. You get all sorts of, mammals living in trees, mammals burrowing underground. Very, very quickly after that.
Do you think it's, you know, the planet Earth could just be like a one-off as a result of that? Because all the chance that, certainly to get to us as human beings or intelligent life that survived, been in a... Because a lot of it's environmental as well, isn't it? So, like, we kind of managed to get through certain periods of time and things have just lucked out for us when the ice ages have ended or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. We've been really lucky the last few thousand years, actually. The last kind of 10,000 years, the climate's been really stable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you think that, you know, it's possible it hasn't, even if the universe is massive, 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 it's possible that no other planet has got to this stage?
That's above my pay grade.
Is it?
I can't even have these conversations. Well, I have these conversations with Brian Cox. He sometimes when I talk to him about it, he said, "Oh no, there must be intelligent life elsewhere." But then we have been listening for a long time, so the fact that we haven't heard anything from space at all, I suppose the other potential fallacy is thinking that there must be other that if intelligent life has evolved somewhere else, it must be there now, or at least it was there whenever it sent its message to us, and it probably isn't there anymore by the time we get to it. Maybe civilizations rise up and disappear.
If there's loads of meteors flying around and smashing into things, what chance you got against that? Unless Bruce Willis is around to save you. So let's quickly talk about the Humanist Association, which are the new president.
Humanist UK. They are now. It used to be the British Humanist Association.
Well,
now
I'm
we're
still
Humanist
UK. I'm one of their whatever it is. Well, I'm one of the blokes in it. And I'm calling it the Humanist Association.
What's it called?
I don't even know what I'm called. Patron. I'm a patron of
the
Brits. No one told
me I'd
change.
Hear it. I'm the president.
I know, it's better, isn't it? Yeah, but for how long? I'll still be a patron in 3 years' time. Where will you be?
What is it? Pothic. President of the Humanist UK by Anne Pothick.
Yeah. That's good. What is humanism?
Humanism.
I should have asked this before I became a patron.
Humanism is... it embraces a whole load of things, actually, but there are a few kind of fundamental foundations to it. Foundations are usually fundamental, aren't they? It's a natural approach to the world. So we basically accept that the universe, the world we live in, it's a natural place, and so we can approach it using our rational cognition. We can approach it using science. But there's a really strong aspect to it, which is about empathy as well. Because I think some people think that atheism is really kind of cold and empty and makes you into a very inhumane person. And that's what, you know, that's the sort of antithesis of humanism. In humanism, we say, no, the world is a natural place. We are evolved biological phenomena. Doesn't make humans any less wonderful. And it doesn't make you any less empathetic and compassionate as a human being, that you don't think there's a God. And in some ways, I think it potentially makes you more moral and ethical. I'm sort of cautious about saying that, but I think when I talk to my religious friends, they have this perception that there's an external source of goodness, whereas I think the big difference between being religious and being non-religious in a humanist way is that I think we create the goodness. It comes from inside us. We have to make it. It's a very moral and ethical way to live your life, but it's based on what you can actually see about the world rather than making stuff up.
It's sort of weird because the made up stuff isn't as good as the real stuff, is it? I mean, the idea that we've all evolved for millions of years and the universe has been here for billions of years and yet somehow we've scurried our way through all of this stuff and that, you know, and that, you know, your progress as a being, all the chance just for you that took all of those ancestors had to survive long enough to create your other ancestors.
Yeah, it's, I mean, most sensible religious people accept evolution. Yeah. And, you know, the Church of England officially accepts it. The Catholic Church officially accepts it. So it's only very fundamentalist religious people who take their sacred texts literally who believe in creationism. But, you know, it is a thing, and we have quite a few schools across the UK that teach young earth creationism. So I don't think we can't be complacent about it. We do need to call it out, because it's anti-scientific.
Can't prove it. They can't prove the earth's more than 6,000 years old, can you?
We have many ways of proving the earth's more than 6,000 years old. Essentially, if you want to believe the earth is 6,000 years old, you've also got to believe in a God who's setting out to deceive you. Because absolutely everything, you know, all the evidence points to an Earth that is, you know, billions of years old.
Testing you.
Yeah, is that the kind of God you want to believe in? That's an interesting kind of God.
Well, no, I want to believe in the kind of God who sets all this up in the first place. What the fuck's wrong with him? I'm going to create a load of people to judge and make them, like, not perfect. I'm perfect, though. Don't know how I manage that. To make them not perfect. And then if they don't do what I think they should, I'm going to burn them up in hell. He's not a very nice person, is he?
No, well, and also the hell issue is interesting, I think, in religion at the moment. Because if you go back sort of 100, 150 years ago, people believed in the physical reality of hell. So there was this kind of, sort of endless battle between good and evil in the world. And God would protect you. And, he was the good side. And then obviously there was Satan and hell on the dark side. So in the 20th century, even quite strongly religious people, I'm talking primarily about Christians here, stopped believing in the reality of hell. So then they've got a really difficult thing to explain. Because if you stop believing in the reality of evil and hell, then how do you explain the fact that there are bad things that happen in the world? Because if there's no force making that happen, then does that mean God's making that happen?
He's given us the choice. But before he created us, there was nothing. Good about. He's mentally ill. I'm happy with that. He's mentally ill, and he goes. I admire his commitment to creating all this evidence to convince you that you're right. It's incredible detail he's gone into. Oh. A lot of it hasn't, you know, probably never get found. It's still down there in the ground, ready to. Brilliant. He's a great guy.
But I think that kind of mature religions are, you know, they're becoming. They're ditching a lot of the stuff like hell, and you know, becoming more, almost more of a kind of a code for living your life. And then if that's all that is, then that's just humanism.
Yeah.
It's just the God bit that's kind of lingering on.
But we sort of, like, again, in a new evolution, the social evolutionary sense, we probably needed religion. I mean, that might be, religion and art might be what distinguished us between Homo sapiens and the Neanderthals, might be. It might be.
I don't think there was that much difference between us, actually. No. Neanderthals did made art. They did cave paintings we know now. They did weird stuff like making little circles of stalagmites in caves. We don't know what's going on there.
Don't know what that's about. And just moving stones around, that's insane. but, you know, that social cohesion that religion gives, it's another cultural identity which makes your group strong. I sort of think you needed it to get through to this point, but if we stick with religion, if we don't leave religions behind now, then we're probably going to be fucked.
One of the problems I have with it, and one of my worries about it, is that it's divisive.
Yeah.
And I think we kind of need to embrace everybody. So, you know, the Humanist UK do all sorts of great things, like training humanist celebrants. You know, we've got, most people in this country are not religious now, but we still need ways of marking those important landmarks in our lives. And so that's one of their important functions. Another important function is supporting people who've left, you know, highly controlling religions in the UK and abroad, where you sometimes have people being threatened, you know, with death because they've left a particular religion. And I forgot what I was going to say next. This never happens.
I have this effect on women. But, you know, I think that's... I forgot what I was going to say as well.
I
was
going to say something great. Just before I started talking
about it. I don't know what's going on. But what was happening? But, no, I think it's because if people believe that... You know, I think if people still believe that God is ultimately looking over us and is going to sort everything out, that's not going to do the planet any good, is it? So we need to take control of ourselves, of the planet, I think, and accept. You thought what it is?
And the other really important thing they do...
So important, I forgot it.
And the other really important thing they're doing is you know, challenging things like having faith schools which can select, on the basis of religion, children coming into those schools. That's just socially divisive. We need to have schools that are for everybody. We need our if we want a cohesive society, we need to have children mixing together. Mm-hmm. We don't want to segregate and separate children out into separate schools. I think that's a really bad idea.
Do you think the world's kind of going to... Do you think the world can work if this sort of rejection of experts and common sense and logic and truth carries on? I mean, that sort of seems to be this little trend we're having now where people can say, I don't care about experts or facts.
People tend to say that until it matters to them.
Yeah.
And then I think when it really matters, they do go to the experts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the doctors and things.
Yeah,
they tend to go,
They're
lying to us.
Yeah.
but do you think that's... It's sort of a weird position we're in right at the moment where that's in, you know, America, UK, we seem to be beholden to these people just talking nonsense and
there is, it's very difficult to gauge it, isn't it? So, I mean, this is... something that Richard Dawkins has attempted to do at various times to kind of gauge how much nonsense is believed by various people. I don't know if it is getting worse or we're just more worried about it. But I think that events and political events and social events of the last few years in different places across the world, I think they do force us to look at ourselves and look at where we're going with our society. It cannot be right that there is a perception that there's a small elite group of people who essentially have the power because they have the knowledge, and then people are worried about that, so they don't want to pay lip service to the experts because that represents this elite group of people. We've got to... Knowledge is power, and we need to share it more widely. So I think the solution is not to kind of throw your hands up in horror about things like you know, trust in science. I think there's still a very healthy degree of trust in science, and you can't just trust a thing without it being trustworthy anyway. But I do think we need to make sure that... science in particular, I'm really interested in the fact it should be a social project that we're all involved in, and we should be doing it more as a whole society. I don't know how we do that. We're trying to think in universities about how we do that better. You know, how we can go out, rather than just talking to the public about the research that we're doing after we've done it, going out to the public much earlier and saying, what research do you want us to do? I mean, scientists are public servants. And I think they'll that's
choose,
part of the...
They'll choose stupid stuff, Alice. The people,
there
the
is
people
always the worry. There is always the Boaty McBoatface worry. Yeah.
But, yeah. Well, in the book, you talk about the fact that the first farmers basically affected the climate when there was like when there's maybe a million human beings, and just the methane or whatever created might have got us through the ice age and changed the temperature of the earth.
You can just start to see these little changes, so you can start to see human impact on the climate, which we think of being a very recent thing and just having happened since the Industrial Revolution, and there's no doubt that it's been, you know, very fast since then and growing and increasingly fast. But there is a little impact that you can see, as you say, when you start, when our ancestors started cutting forests down, that was the main thing.
Yeah.
So when you start clearing forests, you do actually see the normal, it's a kind of, the normal patterns of climate variation are just perturbed.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So do you think, will science save us from ourselves, and will it save the climate, and will stop the climate kind of getting the world in and uninhabitable?
No, science is just a tool. Will save us from ourselves. So again, it needs to be, you know, a whole society, a whole global society coming together to do that. I think we can use science, but we need to use it very carefully.
There's a couple more billion people going to turn up.
Yeah.
But then it's going to level out.
Yeah, it will level out. And also, if we want it to level out quicker, the best thing you can do is help developing countries to develop. Because we know that as soon as a developing country develops, the reproductive rate comes down. So I get occasionally on Twitter there are people going, "Oh, there's too many of us. What are we going to do about it?" And I'm thinking, I'm always slightly worried when people start going, "What are we going to do about it?" I'm like, okay. If you want to do something about it, then give money to developing countries.
Stop having sex.
Give money to projects. You could do that.
These guys are really, really behind that one.
We have discovered though, over the course of the 20th century, we've discovered ways of having sex and not necessarily having children.
Really?
I don't know if that's occurred.
I've had sex twice. It was amazing. Like both times were good. I could talk to you all day, but I'm not allowed to. So I'm going to have to stop talking to you. Let me see if there's anything else I need to talk. I haven't asked you any emergency questions, so that's good.
Are the emergency questions just that they're literally just there in case you run out?
People like them, you know, people like them. But I'm not here to entertain these people. I'm here to find out about having sex with monkeys. That's what I'm here about for. And I've got that, so I'm mainly happy. You like swimming in the wild?
I do. Yeah.
What's so good about that? Isn't it a bit cold?
Yeah, you can wear a wetsuit.
Oh.
No, I just really, I like a swimming pool. I quite like swimming in swimming pools, but I much prefer to swim just in, lakes, rivers, the sea. Much nicer. Yeah. And it's a nice way of being, I did a programme on wild swimming 10 years ago and did this beautiful swim down the Wye. And it is just lovely. I mean, you are immersed in nature and you see nature in a different way. And I remember on that swim, I had couple of kingfishers swim right across in front of me. It's just amazing.
What about the condoms in the river?
Yeah, you can check with the environment agency the cleanliness of the waterway that you're planning to.
When I was about 15, I had to help clear out the river up the gorge. There's a little river runs through, and I picked up a Johnny and I didn't know what it was, and everyone laughed at me because I was holding it.
No.
Just reminded me of that. That's why I don't go wild swimming.
Was that in Cheddar?
It was in Cheddar Gorge. I was just there yesterday. That's what reminded me. I was wheeling my son around because he wouldn't go to sleep. In a pram, I'm not strange. And then I was past that bit. I thought, that's where I got that condom at the river.
Oh, no.
And I went, what? And I didn't know what it was. And everyone was laughing.
They've got lots of cheese shops in Cheddar.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't know what that's about. Oh. It's nice.
I like walking up on the top above Cheddar.
Yeah, it's beautiful up there.
Walking up through the gorge and walking over the top. And there's a really nice place called Drayton Slights. Do you know Drayton Slights? No? No, it's good. Recommend it.
It's beautiful up there. Do visit Cheddar.
It's quite mystical, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's kind of... I was on tour talking about British archaeology earlier this year, and I'm going to do it again in the autumn. But I was asking about this particular find from Starcar in Yorkshire, which is something which looks like it might be a red deer headdress. And it's this kind of bit of bone from the skull of a red deer and the antlers sticking off it. And the suggestion is that these are headdresses. They've got holes drilled into them. My husband, who has been a field archaeologist for many years and always gives the most mundane explanation for anything and hates the any kind of ritual explanation of things, I said to him, look, I can't think of what else these can be. They must be headdresses. I can't see any other reason for doing that. And he said, could be a coat hook. I haven't told the discoverers of the headdresses that theory yet, but I've been going around the country saying to people, right, just you know, checking with audiences, can we do it with these guys? See how many of them think the red deer things might be. Can we have the lights up a little bit? So the red deer skulls that have been kind of carved out with holes in them, and my husband said, well, they could have just been tied onto a post in your house as a coat hook. So can I have a show of hands of who you thinks are much more likely to be kind of mystical headdresses used in ancient dances, ancient kind of pagan rituals? Who thinks it's a headdress? Okay, thank you. Now put your hands down. You're not allowed to put your hand up again. Who thinks it's more likely to be something mundane like a coat hook? Not necessarily a coat hook, but something more mundane.
Definitely a coat hook.
Yeah, that's most people, isn't it? Thank you very much. This is so I'm collecting this data, and I've got a theory... that the closer you get to Glastonbury, the more mystical people become. Because it's not just a north-south thing. Because originally I thought, oh, it's weird. You know, the further north I go, people are much more rational. And the further south I go, people are starting to get a bit more mystical. They like their headdresses. And then it's also an east-west thing as well. So it does seem to be converging on Glastonbury.
It's because there's a lot of crystals in Glastonbury, so they are affecting people's plants.
And
with
witches.
Their magical powers.
There are witches in Glastonbury as well.
You know, my history teacher's related to the Skellington from off of Cheddar Caves. There's a Cheddar man. They did his mitochondrial they did the mitochondrial DNA. It's different. It's a new thing.
Cylindrical mitochondrial DNA.
And he's related to the mum of that skeleton. My history.
Yeah, I think that was based on just his mitochondrial haplogroup. So it meant that 10% of the British population would also have been related to that person. It's not quite as impressive. It's like when people go, "I've got Viking ancestry," and you go, "Everyone's got Viking ancestry."
I'm related
to... We're all mixed up. We're all really mixed up.
Yeah. Bad. I found out about that when I was in Australia and me and Stu were doing the double act in 1997 and we were doing a routine about Mr. Target from my school. We just mentioned him in a routine and the tech said, you know, you're Mr. Target, you mentioned that routine. He's related to a 10,000-year-old skeleton and the news had just reached Australia about this guy. And he recognised it from the routine he was doing the lights for.
I thought you were going to say he was a cousin.
He was. He's probably related.
Long lost brother.
Australians can't be related to those skeletons because they're too far away. Thanks for coming on my podcast. I'm sorry I'm silly. And it's very interesting to hear all that stuff. And come back in 10 years and tell us how everything's all different than what you just told it was.
I want to.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming in. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Alice Roberts here on tour. You have been listening to Rahalastapa with me, Rich Herring, and my guest, Professor Alice Roberts. The music you are listening to is by Pest. Thank you to everyone at Leicester Square Theatre, everyone at Go Faster Strike, everyone at Acast. You're all wonderful. Thank you for having us. I am indebted to my producer, Ben Walker, and to my listeners, not just in the United Kingdom, but all over the world. This is a Fuzz, GoFasterStrike.com, and Sky Potato Production. Go to rahalastapa.co.uk to find out more about this wonderful podcast and how you can help us and come and see me on tour. Bye!
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time.
That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.